Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. What does the West aim to achieve in its Ukraine proxy war? The defeat, humiliation, and breakup of Russia? If this is the case, then the West has already lost. Crosstalking Ukraine and Europe, I'm joined by my guest Matthew Arendt in Montreal. He's a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow and director of the Rising Tide Foundation of Canada. And in Paris, we cross to John Lachlan. He's a university lecturer in history and political philosophy. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. John, let me go to you. You've been following the news as closely as I have been, and with the new iteration of what needs to be done is a ceasefire, creating some kind of security arrangement with Ukraine akin to the Israeli model. I mean, a lot of ink is being spilt, a lot of people are talking, and it's all nonsense because at the end of the day, what needs to be considered is what's going to happen after the end of this conflict and what its ramifications will be, mostly for Ukraine, which I think everyone knows it will be destroyed, and the European Union will be left holding the bag of some kind of rump state. It's very unclear if NATO can even survive this debacle. NATO is the problem. Because of the existence of NATO and its objectives, caused this conflict. Your thoughts, John?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that there are different factions within the American administration. There are obviously the neocon hawks, but there also seem to be some perhaps Pentagon realists. And that's why, as you suggested in your question, there are rumors about a ceasefire, a frozen conflict, a stalemate. All of those forms of words, if they prevail, if that option prevails, the other option, of course, being to escalate the war, which many people are arguing for. But if the frozen conflict model prevails, then that is, of course, a victory for Russia, at least in the immediate and perhaps short and medium terms. What I mean by that is that there are plenty of other frozen conflicts in the territory of the former Soviet Union, obviously in Georgia from the 2008 conflict, in Moldova, in Transnistria from the early 90s. And all of them mean, to put it very bluntly, that Russian troops are in the territories in question and they're not likely to be going home at any point soon. And the reason why I think that that model may indeed be the one that will now turn out to be to prevail is that, of course, we are a few days from the defeat of Ukraine in Bakhmut, a defeat which was initially, it was very difficult to confirm in looking at our wonderful media, because there were different claims and counterclaims, but which I think we can say is now certain, a defeat for the Ukrainian side, precisely because you can't find anything about it in the media. if the fighting was still going on and if Ukraine had any chance of recapturing the city in the immediate future, then we would hear nothing else. So that defeat, and of course the concomitant fact that the famous counteroffensive seems to be being put off more and more, makes me wonder whether indeed there isn't a Pentagon realist faction. We've had rumors of this since December, and whether the Western side, the NATO side, now realizes that actually a frozen conflict is about the only face-saving solution that they can hope for at the
moment. Well, you know, John, I think there's one problem with that. I see your line of argumentation. As usual, it's impeccable. But let me go to Matthew in Montreal. But to have a ceasefire, you have to have both sides to agree. Why would Russia agree?
Well, as Peskov made the point of, you know, it's very difficult to speak to counterparties that have made it illegal to have a negotiation with the current sitting leadership of Russia. So there isn't very much to talk to. If that were to change, the problem still exists, which is, well, what is the ultimate objective regarding the NATO and U.S. handlers of the current Zelensky regime? At the end of the day, what do they want? I think a lot of infighting right now about the fact that what was supposed to happen a year ago did not happen. Russia was not destroyed. It was not crippled economically.
Yep.
A lot of these forecasts that were believed to be the necessary obvious outcome of this this gambit did not happen. Russia is much stronger on almost every variable and every metric that one could look at, especially when compared to the increasingly sinking West. I think that you have all sorts of contrary messaging coming out of the West. I think these are signs of a lot of infighting. Olaf Scholz just said no freeze is going to happen. You have so many different things, and I don't think it is likely. Russia just needs a secure sphere of existence. It needs to have its security interests met. It's not that difficult to understand, and as long as you have ideologically driven, fascistly inclined militarists that are being supported in any way within West Ukraine, it simply is not going to be in the security interest. And to the degree that you have still an open agreement that eventually Ukraine will be brought into NATO at some point, is not acceptable. Russia wants its red lines.
How in the world? I mean, let me turn to John here. I mean, the two biggest problems here that we have is that the West, backed an illegal coup in 2014, brought to power some ultra-nationalists. Let's call them what they are, fascists, because that's what they are, okay? And they've been in power. They didn't have that kind of sway before 2014. What they did was they made illegal opposition parties. Zelensky went even further, monopolizing and nationalizing the media. And then the second shoe that drops, as it were, is the Minsk process. So, I mean, you can't deal with these fanatics in Ukraine that have been empowered by the West and the Europeans. And why in the world would the Russians trust another agreement? I wouldn't. Oh, by the way, who blew up the pipelines? I mean, this is the dilemma we're having, and that's why I think if there is a frozen conflict, it would be under Russia's terms, and the West is just going to have to suck it up. John.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. That's actually more what I meant when I was talking about a ceasefire. I did use the word frozen conflict in my reply because I do think that the frozen conflict model, if you can call it that, is a face-saving device.
Right.
It doesn't. In a face-saving device for the West, of course. Why would Russia be content with that? Well, it seems to me, but again, I'm not a military specialist, that Russia does have difficulty or has had difficulty advancing. We all remember the retreat from Kherson and from Kharkov some months ago. We've seen that the Battle of Bakhmut has been very difficult. We may deplore that fact, but it seems to be the case. It's not as if Russia can go into Ukraine like a knife through butter. It's maybe not just as for the West, it realizes that its desires have come up against the brick wall of reality. The same may be true of Russia, and that is why the thing may fizzle out. I'm not saying it will. It may. After all, there's a lot of talk about escalation. There's a talk about the F-16s and the Leopard tanks and all the rest of it. But it may be that a stalemate is what we're heading to, simply because of the facts on the ground.
Yeah, well, Matthew, you know what this program primarily its objective is to deconstruct all the Western myths in media about this conflict and other topics as well. Let's all remember. Let's do a little bit, go down the path of history and remember, you know, little pluck, you know, Ukraine, you know, against the Russian bear and all that. For 8 years, NATO was building up the military capacity of Ukraine with sophisticated weapons and technology. Okay. Surveillance, the works here. And plus, we have to remember, it is widely believed, I believe it, that when Russia started its special military operation, that was just prior to what the Ukrainians were going to do in invading the Donbass. So they had an offensive posture. They were built up. And this is why it's being so hard to push back. If you look at military in Europe, on the first day of the conflict, Ukraine was second after Turkey in Europe. So, I mean, this narrative, you know, poor little Ukraine, and look what's been poured in since then. Now, for me, it is very, very dangerous to go down the escalation ladder, because that's what NATO is going to do. But they're not going to send those F-16s, Matthew. They're not going to do it because they'll all be shot down. And how is the Americans going to explain as they peddle their trinkets around the world? Well, they all got shot down because, oh, they were Ukraine. Ukrainian pilots, okay? No, these planes were fighting people that were in the Middle East, herdsmen, okay, going up on near-peer power, and Russia has proven conventionally it is superior to the United States. Matthew.
Oh, you've laid it out very, very clearly. I think that, again, there's this ivory tower problem, which, and I'm not a military expert, but I do know when I see ivory tower thinking collapsing when pressed against reality, and there's this idea that all conflicts are somehow created equal on this mathematical playing field. And just because they were able to get certain effects in the Middle East against shepherds and people were, you know, fighting militia style from mountain ranges and what have you, all of a sudden now they're seeing that the same effect is not happening when you have a similar, maybe a quantitatively greater magnitude of military power put into something, because all of a sudden you're dealing with a very technologically advanced society of Russia, which has been able to produce weaponry, hypersonic missiles, and a variety of other things that have change the rules of the game. Many of the weapons that Russia has been able to produce over the last years shouldn't even exist as part of the formula for success of the West. They're not in reality. So I think that there is this problem whereby Russia in the past and throughout the Cold War was not in a situation of economic and political security to the degree that we see today with the multipolar alliance, with its special relationship with China, increasingly also Iran, a variety of other nations of Eurasia. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization has created a strength and a confidence, which I think is rendering many, many Western geopoliticians extremely insecure. And they're not able to formulate or plan what will be done next.
Well, so before we go to the break, throw in, and I'm agreeing with you, de-dollarization that's happening very, very quickly.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is happening at an accelerated rate. Already two-thirds of the trade between China and Russia are being done in local currencies. And that was just one quarter, just in 2021. So you have a vast de-dollarization. That's very important.
All right. On that thought, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine and Europe. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine and Europe. Okay, let's go back to John in Paris. I've debated what's going on in Ukraine ever since it started, and it always gets down to really timelines and perception of time and what needs to be achieved. My position has been, from the get-go, has changed very, very little, is that this conflict will come to an end when Russia is ready and when it believes its security has been guaranteed. Now, however that is, I don't know. No one knows at this point here. But what is the knock-on effect for NATO? NATO is facing an abject failure, okay? And I don't see how it comes back from it. And then even more so, these Looney Tunes running the European Union, what consequences do they face, if any? Because if you disagree with them, they just disappear you and censor you. So I think they feel that they have a free pass to go down these ridiculous green mania, Ukraine, just yeah. Gender nonsense. No consequences if they can control all the media. John.
Yeah, but I mean, we're in the situation of the former Soviet Union, where there is an ideological domination. There is an absolutely fanatical pursuit of a series of policies. Series of ideologies, rather, the ones you've just listed, climate, the green transition, the Green Deal, the gender madness, and so on, all of which have in common the idea, the crazy idea, the fatal conceit, as Friedrich von Hayek put it, that reality can be made to bend to the human will, and that reality can be dictated by volition. And of course, that conceit is now coming to a grisly end in the fields of Ukraine. But the political capital invested in this is so immense that they will never be able to get out of it. And I confidently predict that if we have a discussion in 10 years' time about Ukraine's accession process to the European Union, it'll still be on the agenda, because these things just go on indefinitely in a sort of game of institutional make-believe. And meanwhile, as you suggest in your question, the money is hemorrhaging out, because yes, they've promised to take only recently, only last week, I think they the European Union said it would support Ukraine for as long as it takes. So they think they're in it for the long game. One of the strategies of NATO and the Americans was indeed to lure Russia into a trap and to get Russia entangled, bogged down in Ukraine and in various insurgencies, perhaps even within Russia itself. That was the Afghanistan model, which was proposed in 2022 by an American admiral. That model, of course, was part of the NATO strategy. And no doubt in the first months of the war, they were very happy that they thought Russia had walked into the trap. The only problem is that time is on Russia's side.
Yep.
And the Afghan model, the idea that dragging them into an Afghanistan-style insurrection, which they will fund, which the Americans will fund, that's all very well to have that as a model. And it did indeed last for 20 years. But we all know who won in the end. It wasn't the Americans. So I think Russia at time is on Russia's side, but I do think that this conflict, frozen or not, and of whatever intensity, will now last for 5, 10, 20 years.
Well, Matthew, it gets all down to capacity. I mean, how many more bodies does Ukraine have to throw into this conflict? Unless they want to expand the war and invite, you know, Polish troops in, Romanian troops in, Bulgarian troops in. I don't know why they would do that, okay? I mean, if two words come to mind over the last 8 months, it's meat grinder. I don't see people stepping up that way. You know, clearing out, you know, your warehouses of old Soviet gear is one thing, and that's essentially what they've done, okay? And then the promise of all these trinkets here, they're mostly promises. Yeah, some of the tanks are going in. They're not going to make a difference, and they know it, okay? I tend to think, you know, obviously that there are these planners. I mean, who came up with the idea? Oh, just unconnect Russia from the Swiss system, you know, kick in the door and the roof will fall in. I'm sure somebody was peddling that 18 months ago, okay? And it didn't work. These trinkets, these military trinkets that the West sells around the world, that doesn't work, like the Patriot. Ask the Saudis if it works, okay? I mean, there's at a certain point of capacity where, you know, you can't keep throwing something at it and get zero results. And as John says, I mean, this does cost money, and it's always at the expense of what you can do at home. Matthew.
No, yeah, absolutely. The entire kicking out of Russia was always celebrated to be the great economic time, or the nuclear economic time bomb that was always going to be launched as a special weapon of mass destruction against Russia. And here it is, and Russia's not destroyed. They're actually in a better place, as Iran had already discovered how this works. No, I think if anything, they've created a very, very different situation. A different world has arisen that is much more secure with their alliances. You know, again, I've already mentioned Russia, China, Iran, the whole multipolar alliance. There's a much greater awareness that they're in this for their survival, the survival of civilization as a whole, in order to create diplomatic bridges and economic lines of communication that allow for capacity building and building durable systems that can endure the coming storm of an economic meltdown of the West. And I think that's sort of always hovering in the air behind the economic or the military decisions being made, is that there's this impending doom of the banking system centered in Wall Street and London. The entire transatlantic banking community is sitting on a unpayable debts that are propping up bubbles that are melting down. We're going through a collapse phase. So there is a certain hecticness to try to create, I think, to kick over the chessboard, let's just say it that way, in order to then try to rearrange the rules of the game in the favor of those unipolarists of the transatlantic community that want to control the world. And the majority of the world is simply not having it. That's just part of it.
You know, it's very interesting, John, because you and I have talked about this many times on this program, about the cultural and civilizational angle of it, which never is never mentioned in Western media because they're all neoliberals and secularists. Okay, they don't understand the value of culture and civilization. And more people, when they have the strength and the capacity, will defend that. We've seen that all through this conflict. John, we're rapidly running out of time. This is my kind of prognosis. I usually don't say it in public, but I think Ukraine will survive as some kind of rump state, but it will still have its Banderite leadership. And maybe, I don't know if Zelensky survives or not. But it's very curious, isn't it, that Brussels is going to be adopting a little fascist child to take care of. I think that's not a good look, John.
No, but I think that's what they will do, because after all, if we take the 2008 Georgian War, I mean, Saakashvili was maybe not a fascist, but he, of course, started that little conflict and then lost it. And he was in favor for a very long time. So there's no reason why, given that precedent, they shouldn't do the same thing with Ukraine. And perhaps in due course, the same thing will happen in Ukraine, but in a much longer term, as happened in Georgia, where, as you know, things moved on and the crazies eventually lost power and more realistic politicians came to power. Now, that's really is a very long way off. And indeed, on the contrary, hawks in places like Poland and, of course, in Washington, D.C. are, you know, having wet dreams about the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Yep. And basically expanding Poland into Ukraine and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I mean, everyone is going to carry on with their fantasies. But I just repeat, in whatever form, whether it's in terms of military operations on the ground, economic warfare, political warfare, including in the cultural domain, this conflict will continue for the foreseeable future. There are absolutely no conditions. I cannot see any conditions under which, and as you've said in your earlier questions, either Russia or the Western side will talk to each other. The collapse of confidence on both sides is so total that instead we are in for a war of attrition on all levels, on a multi-spectrum war of attrition. So as I say, even if militarily not much happens, it will of course continue economically in the form of unconventional warfare, insurgency, obviously political warfare and sanctions and so on. As Matthew has very rightly and very well put it, the question is, who can hold out longer? Very often, that's how wars are decided.
Yep.
It's all a matter of timing. And as we have indeed seen, all the stuff about Russia having an economy the size of Spain, which you could just push over with your fingertip, is obviously untrue, not just because it's been proved to be untrue, but also because the figures used to say that kind of nonsense are themselves nonsense. You know, GDP figures are all very well, but if American GDP is just a lot of overpaid lawyers, it doesn't help you win a war. Whereas if Russian GDP is about building tanks or building hypersonic missiles or whatever, then of course that strengthens Russia's position. And I fully agree with what Matthew said about the multipolar world. You know, we talk about China and Russia strengthening their alliance, yes, and Iran, yes, that's all fine. But what about Saudi Arabia? That really is the pivot.
Because,
of course, Saudi, that was not an excluded country. That is, one of the absolute centerpieces of American hegemony in the Middle East and indeed in the wider world. And there we go. Riyadh has now turned its back, I would say, on Washington. So the outlook is, I would have thought, yes, favorable to Russia. But as I say, we've got a long way to go. And in fact, there is no end in sight from the Western point of view, nor indeed from the Russian point of view, because as we said in an earlier question, the Russians have lost all confidence in the Western leadership. And they are unlikely, I think, to sign anything with these people for a very, very long time to come.
You know, Matthew, real quickly here, it really seems to me that the West is just digging its own grave, and it's all because of ideology and greed. 30 seconds, Matthew, goes to you.
Yeah, 30 seconds. I couldn't agree with I couldn't agree more with what John just said. Indeed, I don't think that there is enough humility existent in the technocratic elite of the West right now. That I think there does need to be a sort of truck of reality slamming into the zeitgeist of the governing class. Which is coming on fast. I think the economic collapse is going to be that physical slap of reality, which will then force a crisis whereby people are going to be forced to deal with the consequence of believing in stupid and wrong and corrupt ideas for too many decades.
Well, Matthew, I have a prediction here. I don't care what year it happens, but you know what they're going to say. It was Trump's fault. That's the default. Trump and Russia, you know, whatever combination. Thank you, gentlemen. Yeah. Fascinating conversation. I want to thank my guests in Paris and in Montreal. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.